that I want to do of the book of Daniel, but I'm going to hold that until we get through with the 12th chapter. Many of the things in the 12th chapter we talked about already, but I want to begin at verse 5 with the reading. And I've asked you to do some study on the 11th and 12th verses because we want to talk about those tonight. In verse 5, it says, "Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood other two, the one on the brink of the river on this side, and the other on the brink of the river on that side. And one said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, 'How long shall it be to the end of these wonders?' And I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and swear by him that liveth forever, that it shall be for a time, times, and a half. And when they have made an end of breaking in pieces the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished." Now let's pause there in the reading. We'll pick up in verse 8 in just a moment. But Randy, you were correct when you said the angel above the river raises the question at verse 5, "How long shall it be to the end of these wonders?" The question, I think, relates to the things that have been discussed in verse 1. How long would it be to this terrible period of tribulation alluded to in 12 verse 1 would last? It sounds as if it's a horrible occurrence and a terrible time. In fact, it is described as something that has not been since, nor shall there ever be again. And we see that expression occurring in Matthew the 24th chapter, as Jesus describes the terrible destruction that was to come to pass upon the city of Jerusalem. In the angel's answer to the question, "How long shall it be to the end of these things?" the man clothed in linen swore, as it were, and he said, "Time, times, and half a time." Now, that's an expression in various forms that occurs not only in chapter 7, verse 25, but a number of times in the book of Revelation. And it seems to be a period of troublous times ahead for the nation and its people. These would be finished at the end of the breaking of the power of the people who had been God's people. I want you to turn in your New Testament to Luke, the 21st chapter, where we read of Luke's account of Jesus' statements regarding the coming destruction upon the city of Jerusalem. And in Luke chapter 21, reading beginning at verse 21, it says, "Then let them that are in Judea flee into the mountains, and let them that are in the midst of her depart out, and let not them that are in the country enter therein. For these are days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. For there shall be great distress upon the land and wrath unto this people. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led captive into all the nations. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles, until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled." That's beyond the purpose of our study this evening, to talk about the expression "until the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled." We could talk about that from Acts 15 and some other places. But in this text, Jesus is clearly discussing the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. And in verse 24 in particular, latter part of verse 23 and into verse 24, as he speaks of his wrath unto this people and how that they would fall by the edge of the sword, and they shall be led captive unto all the nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down. The Old Testament writer of Daniel chapter 12 in verse 7, when he speaks of these things, I'm persuaded that he is discussing the things that Jesus is discussing that must be fulfilled in verse 22 of Luke chapter 21. Those Old Testament prophecies concerning the city of Jerusalem must needs be fulfilled. Jerusalem would fall. The nation would fall. And we talked a little bit about that in our last study. The entire prophecy must have been fulfilled by the termination point of the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD when the Romans conquered or smashed through the walls of Jerusalem. In that year, the power of national Israel was shattered. And interestingly enough, how long did it take? 3.5 years. Now, we've got a chart that we're going to look at when we get down to verses 11 and 12 that I think helps us with that just a little bit. In verse 8, the writer continues. In verse 8 of Daniel 12, "And I heard, but I understood not. Then I said, O my Lord, what shall be the issue of these things, or the latter end of these things?" Daniel is now asking the question. And why would Daniel be asking the question? The question has just been asked. Does Daniel ask the question because he doesn't understand when these things will occur? He wants to know more fully, and Daniel is told in verse 9, "Go thy way, Daniel, for the words are shut up and sealed till the time of the end." Now in verse 4, Daniel is told to shut up the words and seal the book even unto the time of the end. What end is being discussed? The time of the end seems to be consistent in these latter chapters of the book of Daniel. What is the time of the end? The fall of Jerusalem, the end of the Jewish entity. That's right. If you'll turn once again to Matthew, the 24th chapter, and look at verse 15. Matthew chapter 24, in verse 15. I've heard that, yes. Yes, a time of incompleteness or imperfection. Yes. Yes, I've heard that. I'm not sure that's what's...
I read the commentary where it says, here the Romans, you know, worried and throwing stuff, they had the 3.5, it was like a broken, incomplete power.
Yeah. Wasn't discussing a definitive period of time, but was discussing incompleteness. Yeah. Yeah, I've heard that discussed. I'm not sure that I agree with that in light of what we read in verses 11 and 12. I think he's dealing with somewhat, at least, of a period of time that may very well have definition to it. We'll talk about that when we get to those verses. But in Matthew, the 24th chapter, in verse 15, Matthew 24, verse 15, Jesus said, "And when therefore ye see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let him that readeth understand." Now what happened to understanding prior to that? Did they understand the fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy? Did they know what Daniel was talking about? But when they began to see the Roman armies encompass the city, then they would know that the things that Daniel was talking about was indeed or were indeed being fulfilled. "Go thy way, for the words are shut up and sealed until the time of the end." They would not fully understand the implications of what Daniel said regarding the destruction of Jerusalem until they began to see those things occur, as they would see them begin to unfold. Now in verse 9, when Daniel is told to go thy way, for the words are shut up and sealed till the time of the end, the vision did not particularly concern Daniel directly. In other words, Daniel's insight into these things really didn't make a lot of difference. Whether he understood it or not, he would die certainly before the fulfillment of these things. And so to try to gain further insight into the things that were being revealed to him was a futile matter. History would unravel those things. It would reveal the very things that was being revealed unto Daniel. Now that's been one of the points of focus throughout the last half of the study of the book of Daniel, as we see history being revealed before it occurred. To know specifically what was being talked about while it was being given to Daniel would be indefinite, but at the time it was being fulfilled, certainly then those things that Daniel was prophesying would be made known. They would understand those things. Any question or comment just here? All right, let's look just a little bit further. In verse 10, it says, "Many shall purify themselves and make themselves white and be refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but they that are wise shall understand." Now here we have basically two groups of people identified. those who would purge themselves or purify themselves, be refined, those who would have insight, and those who would practice wickedness. As we try to identify these two groups of people involved in the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, who would they be? Well, let's turn again to Matthew 24 and note once more verse 15. It says, "When therefore ye see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let him that readeth understand." Now, when those who would read and understand the prophecy of Daniel, when they understood it, what would they then do? When they saw the things that Daniel is prophesying, when they saw the Roman armies encompass the city, what would they do? They would flee. Why would they flee? All right, they understood this is what Daniel is pointing to. Terry? That's right. There would be certain specific signs that are given in Matthew 24 we're going to look at. And they would see these signs and know that these signs prophesied the destruction of Jerusalem to be very near at hand. And it's time for them to flee. Now those who would be purged, purified, or refined, who would they be? Randy?
I
knew that. Go ahead.
Standing in the holy place. Do you think the holy place is Jerusalem? Or do you think the holy place is the holy place in the temple?
I think the holy place has to do with the city of Jerusalem at this point, standing around the city. And the reason I believe that is what Luke tells us in Luke chapter 21, verse 20 through verse 24. Would you mind to read that for me, please?
Twenty through twenty-four. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is at hand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the midst of the city depart, and let not those who are in the country enter the city, because these are the days of vengeance, in order that all the things which are written may be fulfilled. Woe to those who are with child, and to those who nurse babes in those days, for there will be great distress upon the land, and wrath to his people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword, and will be led captive. Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled.
When we read that passage, the Roman armies would do what? It's a parallel to this one in Matthew the 24th chapter.
They would conquer, kill, and take captive.
And where would they be when you see them?
Surrounding Jerusalem.
If they were already in the holy place, and the holy place being the temple, the destruction of Jerusalem would be all over. Be too late to flee.
So the holy place,
well, yeah. Specifically, I think the city of Jerusalem, because it wouldn't be just Judea that would be surrounded. It would be the city itself that's the target of the destruction. Yes, I think so. Terry?
Yeah, around Jerusalem or Judea, the Roman army should not have been standing there.
No.
Place where it should not.
That's right. Should not be. That's right. Okay. Any other comment or question? These who would be purged, purified, or refined would likely be purged, purified, or refined by recognizing that Jesus is indeed the Christ, being persuaded by the gospel. In other words, they would understand these things because they were spoken to them as far as their fleeing the city. Those who were outside of that circle would not understand these things. They would not flee the city. And thus, these would be the wicked who would continue to act wickedly. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, if you would turn there and read with me beginning at verse 13, we see the progress of wickedness, the progressive nature of wickedness. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, at verse 13, it says, "But evil men and impostors shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived." That's just the nature of evil practices. As long as one continues in that vein, it gets worse and worse and worse until you step out of that vein. In Revelation chapter 22, the writer John puts it an interesting way as he says at verse 11. He that is unrighteous, let him do unrighteousness still. And he that is filthy, let him be made filthy still. And he that is righteous, let him do righteously still. And he that is holy, let him be made holy still. Indicating that not necessarily that John doesn't care that those who practice wickedness continue to do so. But once you start down that vein, unless you make some deliberate act to change, then you don't change. Terry?
Mm-hmm. I think perhaps sometimes we may overlook that what you're commenting on there in verse 10 may, in fact, be part of Matthew 28 and 20.
Okay.
Teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. Now, if they observe all things that he commanded, I mean, it wasn't in Matthew 24 and Mark 13 and Luke 21, it wasn't just a suggestion that they flee from his signs.
No, it was commanded. Could very well be. Yes, could very well be. Of course, that message was to be taught in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and unto the uttermost parts of the world.
But it would be Christians who would have the insight.
That's right.
Into that message.
That's right. They would flee. Now, Randy?
I think this may have already been covered, but it was kind of a question that I had before we moved on.
Okay.
New American Standard reads, verse 4, but as for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal up the book until the end of time. Many will go back and forth and knowledge will increase. Do you think the end of time is, mistranslated in the New American Standard?
Not particularly. I think the end of time has to be defined. What time was it the end of?
When you read it, it sounded like you said the time of the end.
Yeah, that's what the American Standard says.
The end of time sounds like literally.
I know it.
Time stops, eternity starts.
Yeah, but that's not the application. The time of the end sometimes could sound that way, but no, he's not talking about the end, the ultimate end of time. If that be so, then none of these would ever have knowledge of what was in the book.
Yeah, I understand that. I remember the first time I read it, I went, oh, this is prophesying about the end of time.
Yeah, yeah.
It says
the end. Yeah.
It's the time of the end.
It's the time of the end, the city of Jerusalem and the inhabitants thereof. Yeah.
It was the end of time for the Jewish people.
For them it was, wasn't it, David? Yeah, yeah. And I think that's implied in the question that they've asked in Matthew 24. Jesus has seen the city and talks to them about the buildings of the temple, how that they're going to be so ultimately destroyed that one stone would not be left upon another. That's verse 2 of Matthew 24. Then at verse 3, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? Now what did they perceive the end of Jerusalem to be? This is it. It's the end of everything. It was the end of the Jewish entity, but they saw that as the end of everything. That's what I'm persuaded is being taught in Matthew 24. They want to know what's going to be the signs of this. And then Jesus begins to discuss with them some things that are not signs at all, and then some things that indeed are signs in which they need when they see these to flee the city. Go ahead, Richard.
I think sort of at the beginning of this chapter, when they ask what they thought was one question to Jesus about the time when these things will happen. They phrase it, and I think they're thinking, they're asking one question, what will be the sign of thy coming and the when all these things will be, and then Jesus, in his explanation, shows them what they're asking is three questions. What is the time of the destruction of Jerusalem? Then what is the time of my coming, and then what is the time of the end of time?
Okay. What is the time of my coming really can be answered, I think, in twofold in the book of Matthew, Matthew 24. Because he talks about when you see the Son of Man coming on the clouds. But that cannot be the second coming. Because if it be the second coming, then how would these things occur upon this generation? He uses language that is used in Old Testament texts regarding temple judgments that would come upon nations of people. And so I think the language that is used there would indicate that really there are perhaps two questions. When he would come in destruction upon the city of Jerusalem, then associated with their concept, the second coming, which he gets ultimately to, obviously in Matthew 25, when he discusses the judgment scene itself, where all nations would be gathered before him. So yes, I think that essentially there are two questions being answered.
The point I was actually trying to make, that I didn't make very clear, is that this shows that the Jewish people thought that these things that they were discussing was, as far as they're concerned, the end of time.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. Yeah, they thought this was the end. Okay. In verse 10 further, it says, many shall purify themselves and make themselves white and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but they that are wise shall understand. The disciples were given warnings. They were told certain signs that would be existent, upon which when they saw these, they were to flee the city of Jerusalem. Those who would not observe these signs were not affected in the sense of leaving the city. The destruction certainly came upon them. Now, Eusebius, we mentioned this, I think, in an earlier study, said that the members of the Jerusalem church, by means of an oracle given by revelation to acceptable persons there, were ordered to leave the city before the war began and settle in a town in Perea, called Pella. Now that's a very significant quotation. Now we were talking about when that particular statement was made, and I did a little research on that, and we learned that Eusebius of Caesarea lived about 263 to 339. Now if you recall the Council of Nicaea, the first council that resulted essentially in the development of the Nicene Creed by the Roman Catholic Church, when was it written? written in 325. So you can see that though Eusebius spanned the time of the development of Roman Catholicism, his statements regarding the fleeing of those of the city of Jerusalem who were Christians, those who were a part of the church there, were closely related to the time frame in which these events occurred. In fact, the theory, at least, that exists that the closest to the time frame that events happen that you have some comment made about them, the more accurate the comment is, and that simply makes sense. Throughout the passing of time, there might be variation in comments, but if you have a comment that's made closest to the time that the event occurred, the more accurate the comment is likely to be. But this man says that those who were members of the church, those who were a part of the Jerusalem church, were ordered to leave the city before the war began. That is, the war that resulted in the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Any questions or comments just here? That's a significant quotation, I believe. Yes, Carolyn?
Any idea where that town is? Does it exist?
I don't know. The province of Perea could probably be identified. I've not researched that yet to find on the map where that might be. But it obviously would not be, or I would think, not too far removed from Jerusalem, okay, or Judea, okay?
What was the name of the
Pella. Can you find that on your laptop or for us right quick? Comment, Terry? You've got your hand kind of sort of up.
A similar statement to that.
Pardon me? No.
I believe there is. I didn't bring the
That would put it closer to the time, well, right during the time of the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Okay, Richard?
Well, hell is actually on the map in the Bible. It's just across the Jordan River, just above Jabesh Gilead, which was, I believe, one of the towns of refuge on the east side of the river. I'm trying to find anything. It's sort of southeast of Beth Shan, or Beth Shean. But it's way up towards the, excuse me, it's way up toward the Sea of Galilee, but it's south of it.
That's interesting. But would that put it in an area of barren wilderness, or would that put it in an area where there was foliage? Down toward the Dead Sea, it would be barren wilderness.
It's north. It's up actually at the northern part of Samaria.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Just east of the Jordan River.
Okay. Yeah. Likely then it would be green up there.
Well, the stuff that I saw over there was sort of desert. Once you got across the Jordan River and got up on the Jordan Plateau, it was kind of like out here.
Oh, really?
But
be a hard place to sustain life there. Yeah. That's interesting. Okay.
Reference I have on that is Aristo, A-R-I-S-T-O. He's an early historian. He was of Pella.
Oh. So we've got at least three mentions then of the city being destroyed and Jews who were Christians fleeing the city. Is that correct?
Yeah.
We've got Eusebius, Josephus, and
Aristo.
I'm not familiar with that writer. Okay. Okay. Randy?
Well, but it's kind of a moot point because Christianity really started growing from Asia. You know, by Revelation, the seven churches of Asia were the ones that were given the letters. What I mean is we don't have any record really of Christianity taking a huge foothold in Pella.
Well, no, but I think the point being made is that there were Christians that is a matter of recorded history that did flee the city. And we've got at least three sources that document that the instructions that Jesus gave were followed. I think that's interesting. And as it is a part of recorded history, it documents when Jesus refers to the abomination of desolation. This is what Daniel was pointing to. And these New Testament period historical writers document that this was followed.
The one I was reading said that after the war, after the destruction and stuff, the Christians came back. Jews, a lot of them were not allowed.
Right. Right. I want you to look, if you would please, at Matthew 23, Matthew 24. As Jesus prophesies concerning the coming destruction upon the city of Jerusalem, at verse 36 of Matthew 23, a very definite statement, Jesus said, "All these things shall come upon this generation." Well, all what things? In verse 32 of chapter 23, it says, "Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers. Ye serpents, ye offspring of vipers, how shall ye escape the judgment of hell? Therefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them shall ye kill and crucify, and some of them shall ye scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of Abel the righteous unto the blood of Zechariah the son of Barachiah, whom ye slew between the sanctuary and the altar. Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation." He's speaking of a very significant judgment that's going to be fulfilled in the period of time in which these live. Now that's very significant for us to see that. He's not using the term generation to talk about an age of time. He's using the term generation like you use it, like it's commonly used and understood. These things would come to pass before your lifetime expires. And then what is it that would be? In verse 37, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that killeth the prophets and stoneth them that are sent unto her, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not? Behold your house, and we've talked about that as opposed to my house in Matthew 21. Behold your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth till ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. And then Jesus in verses 1 and 2 identified the destruction of the temple, the city of Jerusalem, to the extent that one stone would not be left upon another. It would be thrown down. And then the disciples want to know, when shall these things be? Now in Matthew 24, we see some definite signs that were given. Some things, of course, were not to be signs. How many of you have heard someone make the statement that we must be near the end of time? And the reason for that is, well, the Bible says, ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars, and we hear of that all the time, so we must be near the end of time. Had a fellow who professed to be a Christian make that statement to me. And I said, well, have you read the text from which that comes? He said, well, no. And I said, well, let's look at it. At verse 6 of Matthew 24. Ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for these things must needs come to pass, but the end is not yet. Were wars and rumors of wars even signs pertaining to the coming destruction upon the city of Jerusalem? Were they signs of anything? Well, no. These things have always been, and they always will be. There's always been wars, and there's always going to be wars. So the point of the statement is, wars are not a sign of anything, not even the coming destruction upon the city of Jerusalem. But there would be some very specific signs that would come before the coming destruction of the city of Jerusalem. What were some of them? What was one rather significant one that we've just talked about? All right, the Roman armies would surround the city. What else do we learn? What would be another indication, as it were, of a sign? Jesus uses the illustration of a fig tree. Why is that important? What does a fig tree do before it puts forth leaves? All right, it produces fruit. And when it produces fruit, you know that the leaves are forthcoming. That's in the parable of the fig tree, when Jesus said, ye are nothing but leaves. The indication was that there should have been fruit, and there was not. The sign of leaves had time had passed, and there was no fruit. Yes?
After Jesus' crucifixion, or right after, I'm not sure of the time frame, he says that people came forth from the graves and walked around, and also that the curtain in the temple was torn. I would think, for those who were pretty alert,
it was. It was torn and thrown back, indicating that the way into the most holy place is now open and not necessarily restricted to the earthly high priest. But all of these things that occurred caused a particular centurion, when the earth quaked and all of those things occurred, to make the statement, truly this was the Son of God. He understood it. He got the point, as it were. Okay? These signs, they were local. The judgment was local. The judgment was upon the earth. Interestingly enough, you'll notice in the discussion of Matthew 24, the expression of those days in verse 22. And except those days had been shortened, no flesh would have been saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. And then at verse 29, but immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun shall be darkened. And the text continues. But when you get down into the text a little further, you don't read of those days. What do you read of? That day. That day. Now, is he talking about the destruction of Jerusalem? Or is there a change in the language of the text? Seems to be a change in the language of the text. No longer talking about those days, but of that day, singular. There would be time for flight. That is, a place to flee to. Some of you, Randy, talk about the end of time. At the end of time, if the language that's used in Daniel and the language that's used in Matthew 24 be applied to the end of time, would there be a place to flee to? No. And when you use or consider those who use this passage to teach the premillennial doctrine, there would not be the introduction of a 1,000-year reign. Everything would be gone. There would not be any place to flee to if he's talking about the end of time in this language. But in Matthew 24, he's not talking about the end of time. He's talking about a place that there would be to flee to when the city of Jerusalem would be destroyed, not talking about the ultimate destruction of the world. Now, verses 11 and 12. How many of you have done some homework on that?
I did a little study.
You guys are going to help me a lot on that, I can tell. I was anticipating that you would have some answers to questions that I have. Anyway, let's read the text. It says in verses 11 and 12 of Daniel chapter 12, "And from the time that the continual burnt offering shall be taken away, and the abomination that maketh desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,335 days. But go thy way till the end be, for thou shalt rest, and shalt stand in thy lot at the end of the days." Now, Richard and I were talking about some of this last Wednesday night, and I showed him this chart, and I asked him to do the math. Some of you who are mathematicians may want to do the math for me as well. But if I understand what Daniel is saying correctly, and I may not, if we begin the time frame with the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, authorities tell us, Josephus says it was October the 27th. Others indicate November of AD 66, when the Roman armies approached the city of Jerusalem and then withdrew. Of course, we can read about some of this in Matthew's account and in Luke's account, and we've already talked about how that the Roman armies entered into the city and withdrew, and it was during this period of time, or surrounded the city and withdrew. And it was during this period of time that those who were Christians fled into the mountains. They saw the signs and they left the city. And therefore they escaped the coming destruction that was upon the city. In February AD 67, the Roman army begins the siege of the city of Jerusalem. Now remember that they've surrounded the city here at 66 or 66 AD. The Roman armies begin their siege of the city about 67 AD. And authorities tell us, Josephus records that, and I think there's perhaps one or two other places. But on July the 13th, AD 70, the temple sacrifices ceased. They were suspended on July the 14th. That is, they weren't offered anymore. Now do the math. From about November of 66 till about July of AD 70, where does that bring you? 560 days. About how long would that be? No, let's think again. Well, I think you'd be pretty close to this number. About 1290 days. That'd be about right?
Yeah, and that's interesting because...
It is.
Well, 3 years and a half is 1260.
Mm-hmm.
And then the thing I read on 1290 is every 3 years the Jews add a month to their calendar. That's how they add. We add a day every three or 4 years. And they add a month every 3 years to make up because their calendar only has 28 or 27. What do those have?
30 days.
30 days, I believe. 30, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's
every what 30, I read.
So they add a month every 3 years. They add 30 days.
Isn't that interesting? Okay. Now add 45 days to that, and what do you come up with?
1335.
Now, the significance of this 45 days is the question, isn't it? That's the question. Now, if the temple sacrifices ceased, according to what Josephus tells us, on July the 13th, AD 70, that marks us right here. And the text says, "Blessed are those who endure for this 1335 days," in verse 12, adding 45 days to it. From what I understand, from July AD 70 till about September the 8th AD 70, the complete burning of the city of Jerusalem had taken place, and that was about 45 days or so later from the time that the temple sacrifices ended. Now, that's about the best I can make it on the math side of the thing. Terry?
What I came up with was What was your last statement?
That the 45 days is the time between here, I'm sorry, here and here.
In other words, I think you're giving the date of when did hostilities end?
Well, the city was destroyed and burned about September the 8th. Is what I found in my research.
What I came up with was actually about a 45 or 46 day period between the day that the temple was burned and then
from here? Just a little shift.
From what you uncovered. But I think that the key to understanding this verse is not to concentrate necessarily on 1290 and 1335, but to zero in on the difference between those days. There's a significance about the difference between those two sets of days, which these terms are getting at.
Right. And I think really the point that we need to note is in verse 12 at the beginning of that verse. Blessed is he that waiteth. Blessed is he that waiteth. Well, what are we saying? What's the writer saying? Waiteth what? For what? During what? Blessed is he that waiteth. Well, what would be occurring during this 45 days? Whether we shift it or not, what would be occurring during this 45 days?
The
siege and ultimate defeat of the city of Jerusalem. That's right. Now, blessed is he that waits during that time. So the one who waits upon the things that God has promised, he's the one that's blessed. And hasn't that always been so? Yes. 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 Let's turn, if you will, just to amplify the point, to the Old Testament text of Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40. Reading beginning at verse 27. Isaiah 40, verse 27. Why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, my way is hid from Jehovah, and the justice due to me is passed away from my God? Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard? The everlasting God, Jehovah, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary. There is no searching of his understanding. He giveth power to the faint, and to him that hath no might he increaseth strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait for Jehovah shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Who is it that's blessed? Those who wait, those who endure. That's right. Okay. Terry? I don't know. Let me look at my notes just a minute.
Okay. So that one thing that date there is, I believe, is consistent
Okay, 21 would be, well, I think this is from Josephus, Wars 2, 19, paragraph 4.
Yeah, that's a site from Josephus.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, Carolyn?
The dates that you've listed, those are adjusted for all the calendar changes.
Yes. As far as I know.
Because I'm counting up more than, like, from July 13th or 14th up to September 8th. It's a bit more than 45 days as I counted. Are you going for approximate?
I'm going for approximate. Okay. David, you had some comment on these calendars.
It was interesting. I said that the 90 days is exactly 30 days more than 2.5. I could have used calendars. The part about the burning of Jerusalem, and of course then you read several others, and they go back to what's the Greek guy, the
Eusebius.
I read several, and they went all the way back to there.
Well, Carolyn, to answer your question, Josephus uses the Macedonian calendar, but frequently indicates correlations with the Jewish calendar. And then, of course, we've got our calendar to work into that picture, so it gets complicated. Yeah, that I can't answer. I get bogged down, as David said, in it as well. Terry? I don't know about that.
Yeah. Am I right about that?
Yeah, it's in the War of the Jews, book 6, at line 407, it says, and truly so it happened that through the slayer, that though the slayer had left off in the evening, yet did the fire greatly prevail in the night. And as all with burning came the eighth day of the month, Gorpius.
Gorpius was the Roman month.
Elul, upon Jerusalem.
Yeah, and see, in the parentheses, he has
okay.
So when you try to, if you attempt to translate that, it comes out to 45, 46 days between those two events. But then this scenario works. It seems like this scenario works also.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we're going to leave that right there. And again, I want to emphasize, well, we'll have to come back and get verse 13. I wanted to get that before we concluded tonight. And then be prepared for a review of the book next Wednesday night.